Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. You know, most people assume that American religious history is simply the story of a transition from a more religious era during colonial times to a more secularized era during our own day. That story is wrong. It's not only too simple, it's just downright wrong. Rather, what we find is a repositioning of the religious and the secularized. In colonial times, public office such as government, education, and the media were indeed much more often tied formally to religion than they are today. However, partly because Protestant Christianity was an official aspect of public life, private resistance to church participation was more widespread in colonial times than it is today. Church attendance is stronger today than it was during the era of the Founding Fathers. This is lost, really, on most Americans. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way Americans have demonstrated the importance of religious liberty. In America, you have to own your faith, or you're easily drifting away. We'll talk about that, though, with one of the preeminent historians of American religion and culture, Dr. George Marsden, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Notre Dame. You know, there's so many fascinating questions surrounding the role of religion and the development of American culture. You think of what happened in the Cold War, for instance, and how those of us who grew up during the Cold War were told that America represented freedom, it represented family, and it represented faith, as opposed to the atheistic Soviet Union. So there's tremendous interplay between religion and American public life and American culture. We'll talk over some of the aspects of it with Dr. George Marsden in just a moment. Right now, though, let's get to the headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is Robbie Maria Radio News for Monday, June 24th. It's the Solemnity of the Nativity of John the Baptist. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance to seniors in need. Learn more at visitingangels.com. The Trump administration is imposing tough new sanctions on Iran.
Sanctions imposed through the executive order will deny the Supreme Leader and the Supreme Leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support.
Talking with reporters at the White House today, President Trump said an executive order will place hard-hitting sanctions on Iran, which will deny Iran's supreme leader access to key financial resources and support. A U.S.-led economic workshop gets underway today in Bahrain. On Saturday, the U.S. revealed a proposal to create a $50 billion investment fund for the Palestinians and neighboring Arab states. The fund is meant to jumpstart the economy in the Palestinian territories and serve as an economic component of the Trump administration's peace plan between Israel and the Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority has rejected the economic plan and won't attend the workshop. PA President Mahmoud Abbas said Saturday that the economic plan shouldn't be discussed prior to the political one. And Missouri's only abortion clinic will remain open at least through Friday. A judge today extended a preliminary injunction that will allow the St. Louis Planned Parenthood to stay open while its licensing fight with the state continues. The state health department said last week it will not renew the clinic's abortion license. Planned Parenthood and the state will soon battle it out before an administrative panel that decides disputes between state agencies and businesses. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Religion plays an important role in American culture. It has from the beginning. And even with the rise of the so-called nuns, those who are no longer affiliated with any particular religious community, still a high percentage of Americans identify as believers in God or practicing prayer. But many aspects of American culture, of course, have long been secularized, and it's hard to find a field, whether it's entertainment, academia, or the law, where one can honestly say, Christian understandings have a creative or controlling influence. We're going to be spending time looking at religion in American culture with Dr. George Marsden, one of the most preeminent scholars in the field of religion in American culture. He is presently professor emeritus at Notre Dame and a distinguished scholar of the history of Christianity at Calvin Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And he's the author of a newly revised and published book, Religion and American Culture, A Brief History. Dr. Marsden, good to have you with me. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Most people assume that American religious history is the story of decline. We were religious at the beginning, and it's been a constant downhill trend for religion in America. It's from religion to secularism, or secularization, either the social processes of secularization or the ideology of secularism that have been the winners here. It doesn't take too much thought, however, to realize that that story is much too simple. When I was growing up, it was common to believe that simple story of a religious nation that eventually move towards secularism or secularization. When did it become clear to academics that proclaiming the death of religion in American culture was premature?
I think that happened probably later in the 20th century, maybe around the 1980s or so. At least there were some people still saying in the mid-20th century that although religion was flourishing in all sorts of areas in America, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, and others, nonetheless, there was bound to be an inevitable secularization, as was going on in Western Europe particularly. But then I think it became clear that that was not happening. And even in the mid-20th century, people who thought about it realized that there were a higher percentage of Americans were going to churches in the 1950s than were going to churches in the 1750s. So it's been a mix. That there's all sorts of ways in which the culture has become more secular, but then there are religious compensations or religious groups make comebacks that bring a good bit of voluntary religion in America. There's no one dictating what your religion is, so if you have a religion, you have to own it, and that actually creates a more vigorous religious dynamic that people are not just taking the religion for granted.
I think people are stunned to know that church attendance was stronger, you know, in the 1950s than in the 1750s, because certainly those individuals who formed the cultural elite of the 1750s were largely clergymen and theologians. It was also just prior to 1750, you had the First Great Awakening. So people tend to think that America were full of churchgoers at that time.
They had the awakenings or the revivals because the revivalists saw that most people were not going to church and they had to find new methods to try to attract people to the churches, so there was outdoor preaching and very intense evangelism in order to win some converts. But actually, the situation was pretty difficult as far as church attendance. On the other hand, during that time, there was much more official Christianity. As you said, clergy were often very prominent in the society, and there were Protestant ceremonies for most occasions, and before the American Revolution, there were established churches in most of the colonies. But that didn't mean that that religion was particularly thriving, but it was there in an official way a lot more than it is today.
Does that mean that the established church, the principle of an established church itself, leads to less religious attendance, church attendance?
Yeah, I think it would vary, but at least in the United States, that's the way it turned out. That once it was clear that the churches were disestablished, it put them on their own, and so they had to develop vigorous programs for church growth and missions and bringing people together, building the churches, becoming central in new communities to bring people together on the frontier where they needed some sort of positive organization. And then for many immigrant groups, including most Catholics, once people migrated to America, there was a degree of religious toleration and freedom, so that religion became actually more important for people's identity sometimes than it had been in the old country, where it might be taken for granted. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, various ethnic communities used religion, played a really strong role in keeping a strong sense of community identity.
Right, right. So churches or church leaders or evangelists had to become more entrepreneurial, it sounds like, in America.
That's true. Yeah, exactly. That's been this one of the strengths of American religion, that it fits in with the American spirit of finding out a new way to do things. Don't just rely on tradition. That also can be a weakness, because it leads to all sorts of religious variation and some sorts of things that some people wouldn't think are such good innovations.
Right.
But it is a way that has contributed to the vigor of American religion. And it's sort of like the free enterprise system, that all sorts of people can find new ways of doing it and making it effective.
Yes. You quote Lyman Beecher, a leading congregational evangelist and one of Connecticut's champions of anti-disestablishmentarianism, saying that the ending of state tax support for Congregationalism was the best thing that ever happened to the state of Connecticut, because it threw the formerly Puritan churches on their own resources and on God. And so he's echoing what you're describing here. The church now
exactly,
had to focus
yeah.
on voluntary efforts, voluntary societies, voluntary missions, voluntary revival.
Yeah, and that's in the early 1800s. He was actually the father of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and of a very prominent religious family, and was part of a national revival that really did reclaim a lot of the religious fervor in America in that time. And up until the Civil War era, there was a very strong Protestant evangelical kind of religious growth.
Now, you have a section that you call the Age of Democratic Revivals, which runs from 1860, or excuse me, that's an age of Protestant and progressive America from 1860 to 1917. Prior to that, you had the Age of Democratic Revivals. What happens with the Civil War? That seems to be a marker of major cultural change
yeah.
regarding religion.
Yeah, the Civil War is in the North and a very important engine toward the modernization of America that it was won largely because of Northern industrialism and proved to be a kickoff for a lot of economic growth. And it led to what's been what Mark Twain called the Gilded Age instead of a golden age of prosperity and goodness. There was a Gilded Age of people taking advantage. So there were some, after the war, some disillusion with the traditional religious promise, but then compensation for that with Protestants who are saying we need to have more of a social emphasis in religion. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in the South, the effect of the Civil War was to the idea of the lost cause became a kind of sacred ideal, as it is for some people still today. And part of the Southern culture before the war was this evangelical kind of culture. So that became sort of the default, remains sort of the default religion in a good bit of the of the South. So the South became more conservative religiously, and the North still was quite religious, but it was a more mixed with a more progressive. Sure. Religion. I might say also African Americans who had been evangelized during the pre-Civil War era to some extent, then were on their own, and they thrived very greatly religiously. Religion became mm-hmm. extremely important as a kind of way of coping with,
right.
With the discrimination against them.
Dr. Marsden, hold it there. We'll be right back.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, Comfort Keepers of Plymouth, promoting the National Day of Joy on June 26th. They honor senior caregivers who elevate the human spirit by bringing joy, love, and purpose to each person they care for. For more information, call 734-397-1111. That's 734-397-1111.
In this moment, who has your back? Do you know the name of your insurance agent? Does your agent know your name? Or would you call a 1-800 number that connects you with who? Another state? Another country? Get a local independent agent. Get Choice Insurance Agency, representing auto owners insurance. Someone you can call when bad stuff happens. Call Greg at Choice Insurance at 734-641-4200, who will protect you in that moment. Call 734-641-4200.
Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Now, on the Ave Maria radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks, under the prayer section on the Ave Maria radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
Did you know that the words listen and silent have the same letters in them? Coincidence? Maybe not. Because in order to truly listen, you must be silent. That is not always easy for a girl who likes to talk, and one who's been trained to do so on the radio. But in order to hear God's words, I must be silent. I must truly listen in order to hear. In Psalms it reads, "Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I'll be exalted in the earth." We must be silent in various situations, not just in prayer. Silence is sometimes needed in everyday conversations with friends, family, and colleagues. See, I like to talk, so shutting my mouth so others can be heard is something I have to work on. You are trained to do so as a broadcaster. A good interviewer listens to the guest in order to take the conversation where it needs to go, where God wants it to go. This has been a Christ Center Communication Message. I'm Vanessa Denhagarmo, a communications evangelist.
Hi, everybody. Dr. A here. Well, being a grandparent's just like being a parent, isn't it? Only different here. I have a book with that same title. And in that book, I take on the ups and the downs of being grandparents. It's a second go around with the kids in a way that mirrors God's own unconditional love for us. You can get the book and my many others at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. George Marsden, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Notre Dame, and again, one of the premier historians of American history, with a special view towards the interaction between religion and American culture. The book we're looking at right now is called Religion and American Culture, A Brief History. What changed in the nature of revivals? There's the age of what you call the age of democratic revivals. With the 1860, American religion changes with the Civil War. How do revivals change? Do the techniques change? Does the leadership change between before 1860 and after 1860?
Yes, to some extent. As some of American Protestantism after the Civil War, as I said, became more progressive and more oriented toward a social gospel, mm-hmm. then as a result, others were developing revivalism in what you call a more sectarian spirit, or not necessarily the mainline churches, but groups that are reaching out to the poorer classes, and you get very popular revivalists. There's a whole series of famous revivalists in the late 19th century, Dwight L. Moody, and then he's followed by Billy Sunday, who was an ex-baseball player, mm-hmm. and very colorful revivalist in the 1920s, and then after World War II, you get Billy Graham. And by the time of Billy Graham, Billy Sunday and Billy Graham, the revivalists represent one segment of American Protestantism, but then they are often strongly criticized by people in some of the larger Protestant churches who are more liberal and think that that revivalism is a sort of superficial Christianity. So some division develops within the religious community, the Christian community, between people who are more traditional in their theology and particularly Protestants emphasizing the Bible and it's the truth of the traditional Bible story, and more liberal Christians who are emphasizing more of the ethical dimensions mm-hmm. of Christianity should be central.
So those later revivalists are emphasizing more the kind of the personal piety side of religion. Whereas earlier revivalists not only had that, but they also had a larger social dimension. Is that right?
Some of them did, yeah. In the pre-Civil War era, revivalism was very closely connected with some social reform, particularly in the North and the anti-slavery movement. So, as for instance, Harriet Beecher Stowe, daughter of Lyman Beecher, we mentioned before, was in that evangelical tradition, but very strong influence on the anti-slavery movement.
Right, right. Does the progressive movement, using Teddy Roosevelt as the example here, does the progressive movement end up becoming more of a secularized revival movement?
It's an example of there is a sort of a coalition of religious and secular kinds of interests. So you might get just progressive politics that have essentially secular concerns that you think this is better for America or better for economic development, whatever, and then other people who are religious who promote the same kind of thing, and you often get that in the interrelations of religion and politics, that you'll have some people who are pushing a certain political kind of view for purely secular reasons, and then because of the political parties or coalitions, religious people come aboard and provide religious rationales for what's going on. Mm-hmm. Or there might even be religious origins for some of the policies. But it's always a mix. I wanted to call the book Mixed Blessings because that seems to me to be a central theme in American life, that it's a very religious place in many respects, an awful lot of religious people, but then it's a very secular, materialistic culture in many ways, and that's always a challenge for all of us. How do you fit those things together? So
right.
I'm trying to understand how that's been happening for a long time.
Well, we saw that in spades with the televangelist, the rise of the televangelist in the 1980s, and the PTL club, and the you have a kind almost a consumeristic kind of Christianity that's being emphasized.
That's one of the I mean, that's why you get these sort of paradoxical strengths and weaknesses, that American religion encourages innovation, but then it can get, in my view, I mean, it can get out of hand, and sometimes evangelists will use American tendencies toward materialism in order to sort of promote Christianity or saying that Christianity will bring you prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main,
right. Yeah.
The main reason you should be involved.
Let me Protestantism is really the dominant religion in American history. Let me ask you about Catholicism, though. Does the Catholic experience, it's certainly different than Protestantism, but does it follow the same trajectories, or is the Catholic experience really quite different?
I think I would say it's quite different in that from the 1840s, when you begin to get large-scale Catholic immigration, until 1960s or so, I mean, say with the Kennedy election,
mm-hmm.
Catholics are pretty much discriminated against, and they that forces them to build very strong religious cultures, and the Catholic Church really in America thrives under that circumstance. And then after Catholics become more part of the mainstream, then I think in the last 50, 60 years, the experiences and the challenges are much more like in the Protestant churches, that it's a challenge of how do you survive in a where there's no sort of base community where Catholicism is simply taken for granted,
mm-hmm.
and how do you survive as a voluntary religion, and that these are some strengths that, as I said before, that it encourages
people to really own whatever religious commitment they have. They have to understand why they have it, and it may strengthen commitment, but it's also a challenge to keep the churches of all sort, and all religious people are constantly being bombarded by all sorts of other media and cultural attractions that, you know, would lead them away from religion. So it's a constant give and take.
When do America's cultural elites begin to believe that Christianity is no longer essential to America's national purpose?
That's a gradual process. There would always be some who might say that. I mean, you go back to Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson. Well, they would think religion is essential to America's purpose, but not necessarily traditional Christianity.
That's right. Yes,
but it's not until in the 1920s, you're beginning to get a lot of skeptical intellectuals, and there's a real division between religious people and intellectual people. But even through the 1950s, you're still having cultural leaders, Eisenhower, for instance, saying, you know, religion is central to the American cause. And as long as the Cold War is going on, a lot of cultural leaders are seeing America as standing for a religious tradition against godless communism, and so that's a pretty common thing to say, even though it would be contested in the universities or in a lot of the intellectual cultures. There'd be plenty of people criticizing that. And then after, say, the 1970s or so, it becomes much more common to have cultural elites be skeptical of the religious dimensions of America.
Mm-hmm. Who would be the last great Christian public intellectual?
Probably Reinhold Niebuhr.
Yeah.
He was still in an era when you could sort of think of America's religious outlook as though it were had some coherence to it, and or Martin Luther King in the same era can appeal to a broad American religious tradition. Mm-hmm. But since then, America has become so much more fragmented that it's very difficult even for people who have a lot to say to get a hearing outside of their particular community.
Right, right. Dr. Marsden, can you stay with me another segment?
Sure.
Great. My guest is Dr. George Marsden. He is one of America's preeminent historians of American religion and its relationship with American culture. We're looking at religion and American culture, a brief history. And we got another segment coming up. Stay with me.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Are you longing for a real relationship with Jesus?
Do you desire to truly know Him?
Not just know about Him?
Then Lord Teach Me to Pray is for you.
Lord Teach Me to Pray, an Ignatian prayer series, invites you to a training retreat.
Saturday, June 29th at St. Paul of the Cross Passionist Retreat Center in Detroit.
Register at LordTeachMeToPray.com.
Don't pass up this invitation to deepen your relationship with Jesus while helping others do the same.
Register today at LordTeachMeToPray.com or call 504-439-5933.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Join me, Teresa Tomeo, and Father John Ricardo for fun fellowship and beautiful weather during our Good News Marriage Cruise. Former NFL star Matt Burke will also be there sailing the Caribbean as we explore how to rejuvenate your marriage in Christ. We're sailing January 26th to February 1st, so call 855-879-6932. That's 855-879-6932. Or visit AveMariaRadio.net for early registration discounts.
What are the doctrines Catholics believe, and why do we believe them? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews for more than a minute with the Catechism as I quiz the experts, top theologians, philosophers, and catechists to share the truths about our Catholic faith. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
On our next program, Archbishop Alan Vigneron will be our first speaker as we complete our coverage of the Archdiocese of Detroit's Life is a Gift Conference.
This is always the vocation of the lay faithful, because in this democracy, it is the people who rule, and it belongs to us to shape the civil order. Specifically today, this then is the vocation of restoring the right to life. We are at a moment when this right not simply has to be defended, but it has to be vindicated.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Archbishop Alan Vigneron called the attendees to holiness and to witness to the gospel of life. And before we close the coverage, Dr. Michael Kinney takes a legal look at when life begins. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEL, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Want to grow closer to your spouse? Try something new. Research shows that couples who make an effort to try new experiences have happier and more secure marriages than those who do the same things all the time. You don't need a ton of time or money to mix things up. Cook a meal together for a change and try a new recipe. Take a walk around a different part of the neighborhood. Turn off the TV and play a short game tonight. Let creativity be your guide. For extra bonus points, let your spouse choose something they've always wanted to do and go along with it cheerfully, especially if it challenges your comfort zone. A little openness to new experiences goes a long way to making married life more enjoyable and long-lasting. Want more ideas? Check out my book, For Better Forever. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, with me Dr. George Marsden. We're looking at religion and American culture. The 1960s is a watershed moment, it looks like. Not only the sexual revolution, but in many ways a cultural revolution that occurs. The mainline Protestant groups that had been so important through much of the 20th century up to that point begin to lose their bearings, apparently, and there's a resurgence of conservative evangelical Protestantism. Can you describe a little bit of how that shift occurred?
Yes. Up till the 1960s, mainline Protestants tended to be in cultural leadership, and it was sort of taken for granted that America was a Christian, was in some very broad way a Christian place or represented, that Christianity was part of it, and that, mm-hmm. that meant mainline Protestantism.
By which we mean the American Baptist Church, the United Methodist Church. At that time, I think it was United Presbyterians, but the large Protestant denominations.
The large, you're right. The larger Protestant, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, and other other large United Church of Christ groups such as that were very prominent. Then in the 1960s, you begin to get coming partly out of Protestantism itself, the idea that America should embrace more diversity. And you first you get the idea of Protestant Catholic Jews, and then you get racial integration, and then the countercultural kind of spirit of the 1960s, and white Protestants and white Protestant males particularly begin to apply that lesson to themselves and say, well, we need to be more inclusive, and that actually leads to a sort of informal, in a way, a disestablishment of whatever authority that the Protestant, you know, that kind of Protestantism had. So after 1970, there's nobody that really speaks for American religion in any decisive sort of way, and that's part of that fragmentation. Mm-hmm. That leads to the fragmentation that there's no real religious center anymore.
Right. Catholics have had the Second Vatican Council, and by 1974, I think they've lost 50% of their church attendance after the Second Vatican Council. Billy Graham has grown up through this period as an important religious figure, not as a public intellectual, but as an important figure. But he's primarily the darling of evangelical or conservative Protestants. Is that right?
Yeah, by that time there's a pretty sharp division between more liberal or mainline Protestants and then the evangelicals who are associated with Billy Graham, and then even more conservative people who call themselves fundamentalists, who are more militant. They want to fight for the faith and fight for bringing back Christian elements in American culture. So Protestantism has a spectrum of beliefs, and Billy Graham represents sort of the center right of that spectrum.
I want to just go to the world of ideas for a minute here. How important were intellectual conflicts over evolution or biblical criticism? How important were those originally more academic areas? How important were those debates for the waning of public Christianity?
I'd say they were important more for the division in Protestantism between the more progressive people and the more conservative, that as more progressive Protestantism develops, conservatives are emphasizing the Bible alone and the inerrancy of the Bible. There's no errors in the Bible, and particularly in the Genesis story is pretty literal. So the earth can't be as old as people who believe in evolution would think it is. And that becomes not only an intellectual debate, but a very popular debate in the 1920s. Leads to the famous Scopes trial in 1925 with William Jennings Bryan, the very prominent political leader who becomes a defender of creation, of young earth kind of creation versus evolution, versus Clarence Darrow, who was a famous skeptic of the era. So
There's a very popular kind of biblicism that is often you could say the Bible is our authority. We don't need to listen to the cultural elites. It develops in the 1920s and continues to this day. That you can find lots of people who are distrustful of intellectual elites and also saying we need to just have a much more traditional kind of religious base for the way we think.
Is it common, in those kind of situations, is it common for religious believers, say, in the Bible, over against the majority world picture that the culture has? Do they tend to become combative?
Yes, yeah. That's my definition of, a short definition of fundamentalism is a Christian who's angry about something,
okay.
Which is to say they want to, you know, not only do they differ from other people, but they want to make something of it, and it becomes, for some religious movements, quite central in their identity, that we stand for this set of non-negotiable doctrines and beliefs, and we are against society, parts of society that don't think that. And
mm-hmm.
Some of the homeschooling and traditional Christian schools, but Protestant Christian schools, have that sort of sense of.
Sure.
We stand against the secularizing mainstream culture.
Right, right. Let me, one thing you point out is that one thing we learned from a study of the past is that we can't reliably forecast the future, but that doesn't keep us from trying. So
yeah.
Let me ask you, what does the 21st century look like for American Christianity or American religion?
Yeah, and as you say, I usually duck that question and say, you know, for instance, in 1985, no one was expecting the fall of the Soviet Union,
right.
and that changed everything.
Yeah,
and actually, as far as religious history is concerned, it made people realize that religion is still really. Very much around, that things are not just secularizing. So it's really hard to predict that there are some trends of particularly younger people falling away from the church, but then that's hard to know what it means for the future, because there is a pattern of people coming back to churches once they finally settle down, and people in their 20s now, you know, often are postponing marriage and
mm-hmm.
and commitments of any sort. But what's going to happen to them 20 years from now, we can't really predict.
Didn't we see that with baby boomers? A falling away from Christianity and then kind of a return?
Yeah. Right. There's such a pattern. So a good many people are saying, well, you know, the churches are falling apart because younger people are not there, but maybe they'll come back, and we really can't be sure about that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Christianity's center of gravity shifts to the global south. I'm not sure that is. I'm not sure many people are aware of how big a shift that has been. Can you describe that remarkable development?
Yes, there are actually far more Christians in Africa than there are in Europe today.
That's amazing,
and that. I have a quotation here. I can't reproduce it right exactly, but that There's more Anglican, you know, on any given Sunday morning, there's more Anglicans in some countries in Africa than there are in Canada or Great Britain. And, there's more Catholics than there are in some of the traditional, Catholic, countries. And so, the growth of Christianity around the world is really truly remarkable in the very era that scholars were predicting secularization. After the 1960s or so, they said, well, you know, as industrial modern civilization develops, religion's inevitably going to decline. And after colonialism, then Christianity and missions will disappear. But the fact is that after the end of colonialism, in the global South, people, you know, develop their own religious leadership, and they have thrived. And even in China, where religion was repressed, there's an awful lot of religious growth. So it really goes against that whole secularization narrative that people used to have, that the more modern society is, the less religious it will be. What happens is that as modernization takes place, voluntary religion seems to grow as a way of compensating for the loss of community that modernization often involves.
Mm-hmm. And so at least for the time being, it looks as though Christianity still has a story going on.
Actually more than you might realize. And if you just look around you in the Western world, it might be discouraging, but if you look at the wider world picture, there's an awful lot going on.
Yeah.
And there are church, I mean, in Catholic Church too, the Global South part of the church becomes increasingly important.
Indeed. Well, Dr. Marsden, thank you so much for joining me once again. Your work has been a great help to me over the years
as I've tried
to orient.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Dr. George Marsden, Religion and American Culture, A Brief History. I'm Al Cresta.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 10 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company, and it's sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan cost goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
We recently prevailed in a lawsuit filed in an Oklahoma federal court by Raja E. Fatia, a Muslim and a board member of CARE Oklahoma, against Chad and Nicole Neal, the owners of an Oklahoma gun range. Fatia was represented by lawyers from CARE, the ACLU, and a large New York law firm, the usual suspects. The American Freedom Law Center represented the Neals. The controversy arose when in 2015, Fatia entered the Neal's gun range armed with a loaded military-issue handgun strapped to his side, a military-style rifle slung over his shoulder, magazines loaded with approximately 140 rounds of 9mm ammunition, a concealed recording device in his pocket, and a dangerous agenda. To create a controversy with armed individuals at the gun range, hoping that he would not be allowed to fire his weapons so he could file this meritless lawsuit and run to the media with his prearranged Islamophobia narrative, knowing that the liberal media would willingly serve as an echo chamber for his spurious claim of discrimination. CARE's lawsuit was dismissed with prejudice. CARE's extremely reckless and dangerous attempt to set up a lawsuit to make a political point has failed. Apparently, CARE and the ACLU didn't want to put CARE's nefarious ties to terrorism on trial, so they caved in. And in the end, the good guys won yet again.
I'm Robert Hughes, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, enjoying talking about religion and American culture, but also reminding us that in Catholic history, we know the extraordinary geopolitical consequences of the revelation at Fatima. And so, again, calling us during these difficult times to pray the rosary regularly. Thanks for being with me today. And keep us in mind, when you turn off the radio dial, we can be reached at AveMariaRadio.net. I'll see you tomorrow.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.